Blog Talk Radio.
Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we will present an hour-long discussion on the nature of evil and the theory and practice of black magic. Now, we'll avoid popular goth role-playing and steampunk vampires, and we'll get down to the real history and actual practices of the black magicians and the serious Satanists. Now, fortunately, the role players are in the majority. We'll make it very clear that summoning and commanding dark powers by the power of light for worthwhile purposes, such as personal development, is not black magic, and was not even thought of as black magic. And no magicians in the old days didn't make pacts with demons or the devil, not until the advent of the Faustian school in the 18th century. Before that, the good magicians were getting the demons to do nice things for them, and they were very pious about it. Actually, black magic, and this is... Now we're getting down to the real nitty-gritty here. Black magic can be done in white robes, calling on Jesus and the Archangel Michael. Oh, yeah. More people have been really cursed and destroyed by the Archangel Michael than they have been by most of the demons. We'll discuss the oft-maligned Church of the Final Judgment called the Process, and the widespread obsession with authenticating Howard Phillips Lovecraft's Necronomicon. And some of what you hear may be disturbing, not because of what black magicians do, but rather who they are and why they do it. So, tune in and we'll shed some light on the dark realm. Now, if we have anybody who really wants to defend any what you think is black magic, you can call in and we'll give you a minute or so to try to rationalize what you're doing if you wish. We're not all that unsympathetic. So call in, and our guest call in number is 347-857-1830. Now, let's talk first about what evil is. Now, this, of course, is going to be my opinion, and I'm going to try to define evil for you from a hermetic perspective and from a magical perspective. And so it's not going to agree with what a lot of you think evil really is or whatever. Now, just for reference, F. Scott Peck, who was, I guess, an Episcopal minister at one time and wrote several books on the subject, he wrote a book on what he thought was an explanation of evil. And I read it, and I was wondering just where... I don't think this guy had the faintest conception of what real evil is all about. He thought that a father who put a lock on the refrigerator to keep his children from getting fat was evil. Oh, that's not evil. It might be bad, but it's not evil. And it might even be good. And at least Father thought so. No, let me give you a good explanation, a graphic analogy of evil. Peck, in his book, he used the My Lai massacre in Vietnam as a kind of an idea of what he called evil, and he discussed the captain, the infantry captain who wiped out the village, mostly civilians, and of course, yeah, got caught, got court-martialed, whatever, as an example of evil. I didn't understand, really. Let me put it this way. Now, having been an infantry officer, an infantry captain, I never wiped out a village, but yet I understand a little bit more about this than F. Scott Peck. Now, there are two people involved here. One of them is the infantry captain, and the other one is the colonel who gave him the order that got this whole thing started. Now, the colonel brings in the captain, and he says, "Captain, we've been ambushed from that village 4 or 5 times. Every time we fly over, we take fire from that village. We have a lot of problems with that village. I want that village neutralized. I don't want any more problems from that village, and I want it taken care of tomorrow. You got that?" And the captain says, well, sir, how do you want me to carry that out?" And the colonel says, "Don't ask me for details. That's your job. Just make sure we don't have any more problems with that village. Got it?" And the implication is, of course, if it doesn't do the job, there goes his efficiency report, and he better look for another career. So the captain takes his company out there and surrounds the village and sits in his jeep and gets drunk while the sergeant takes the boys in there, and they kill everybody in the village, men, women, children, babies, and everybody. Okay? Now, who is bad? Now, let's remember now, we got the captain and the colonel. Now, who's bad and who's evil? Now, if you think the captain is evil and the colonel is bad, you're wrong, at least from my point of view. It's the colonel. He's the evil one. He is manipulating this young man into doing something that he doesn't want to be responsible for, but he wants done, and he's put this kid in a position where he has to go out and do this, or his career is over. Now, that's evil. Calculated, vicious, self-serving evil. Whereas the captain who goes out and sits there and drinks himself into a stupor and turns his back and says, "Sergeant, get out of there, kill them all." That is bad. I mean, it's really bad. It's horrible. It's an evil act, but it's not. But he's not an evil man. Now, if we understand that, and if you agree with me on that, then we have some idea of the nature of evil. Now, I define evil by understanding about human beings. Most human beings are basically good in the context of their culture. And I got some pretty awful cultures. I mean, some cultures can do some evil things too, or things that other cultures think are evil. But still, most human beings do not want to kill other human beings. They don't want to kill them. They want to get it over on them. Sure, they're competitive. Human beings are very competitive. But they want to be honest, and they want to be fair. They want to be competitive, but they don't want to kill. They don't want to cheat. They don't want to murder. They don't want to. These are things that normal human beings don't want to do. But then there is anywhere from 5 to maybe, always, some estimates are all the way up to 10% of people who are born without any empathy for other human beings. They don't have that. They're, you know, granted, human beings are social animals. We have to have a certain measure of cooperation. You know, that's the way we are. I mean, that's our nature. But then there's some people who are born with that reptilian part of their brain is dominant, and the governor, that little governor. In fact, there's been some research done recently where they've actually, some neurologists think they've actually located this little thing, and that in the sociopath, and I know that's a term that's almost a politically incorrect term these days, but a sociopath is not, they're not insane. This is, in fact, some of them, unfortunately, are geniuses, but they don't have that little gland or whatever the heck it is, that little factor that we would call a conscience. That little thing or entity that makes you feel guilty if you do something bad. They don't have it. And this gives them, of course, a tremendous advantage if they are intelligent. It gives them a tremendous advantage in business. It gives them a tremendous advantage in the military. It gives them a tremendous advantage in politics. So unfortunately, we find too many of these this 5% or 10%. And they get to be, some of them get to be CEOs in business, and some of them get to be high-level politicians, and some of them get to be way up in the military. And these people are what the rest of us would consider evil. Now, they may not. They don't think of themselves as evil. They're out for number one, and they don't care who gets in their way. And they obey the rules only because it serves their purpose to do so. But if they can figure out a way to break the rules and do and get advantage over somebody else and get away with it, they're going to do it. And so these people will manipulate and dominate and deceive and exploit other human beings with no conscience whatsoever. Now this to most of us, not to the sociopaths, but to most of the rest of us, this is evil. Is when it was one human being sets out to exploit, dominate, deceive, manipulate other human beings for his own advantage. Notice I didn't say for a good cause or something like that, because sometimes non-sociopathic people will do all of this if they're convinced they're doing it for a good cause or the old Marxist idea, the end justifies the means and all of that. So they will do a bad thing or even an evil thing, but they're not basically evil themselves because they're doing it for something they believe in. And yet, the real evil is those who do it for their own personal power and their own personal aggrandizement and do it at the expense of others. So that is what I would consider the definition of evil. Now, granted, different cultures have different ideas about what's a horrible thing to do. I mean, the old Apache Indians back in the old days, if a baby was born was kind of sickly and maybe had a birth defect or something like that, they'd just take them out and leave them out on the mesa and let them die. And that was their culture. And so that wasn't, we think that's horrible. But with them, that was survival. And that was the way their culture was. So from their point of view, that's not evil. Okay? But from our point of view, that's hideous. So evil is in the eye of the beholder, and it's quite often culturally defined in this respect. But what real, intrinsic, deep-seated evil is the realm of the sociopath. The realm of the human being who preys on other human beings. This is real evil. it's my way of thinking. And, you know, from a philosophical point of view. Now, this means that authoritarian systems like Soviet Marxism and fascism, Mussolini's fascism and Nazi fascism, and these are perfect vehicles for the sociopath to exploit. In fact, you know, you could say that this 5%, and this 5%, by the way, has been with us for a long, long time. I wrote an article in the second issue of our new Seventh Ray. It's called The Red Right, called Return of the Dragon Lords. It's kind of a bit more sophisticated version of what David Icke has been talking about with the draconians, the reptiles among us. Well, the reptiles among us is a romantic way of pointing to the sociopath. The sociopath is more his, the reptile part of his brain is more uninhibited and more active in acquiring what he wants. It isn't inhibited by what we call a conscience. And so these are the people who you might refer to as the dragon people, the draconians. And I know Ike said that, I won't mention who, some great world leader took off her mask at night and went to bed as a crocodile. No, I don't think so. But you know, there could be a crocodile there. I mean, even though the mask is not. Now, having defined evil, let's, at least having defined it the way I define it, let's talk about evil in relation to magic. And let's talk about what black magic really is, as opposed to what various people from different directions would think it is. Now, the first thing we need to understand is that about this is that back in the Renaissance, when we had the Hermetic revival in the Renaissance, and we had a number of really, really brilliant Neoplatonic philosophers and intellectuals were fully robed and wand-waving ceremonial magicians. Giordano Bruno and Campanella and Ficino and Pico della Mirandola. These people were highly respected, well-educated, fortunate individuals writing books and getting imprimaturs from the Catholic Church on their books. And they actually, the magic that they were doing, they did not differentiate. I didn't say, well, we're not going to deal with evil spirits. Oh, they did. But they did it with the power of God. They did it with the angels and God on their side. And they used these elementals and these so-called rebellious or evil spirits for worthwhile purposes. Or at least that's what they said, right? And nobody really objected to this, and this was not black magic, because they weren't doing this supposedly to hurt anybody or to take advantage of anybody. They were, and yet, about 1614, a philologist by the name of Casaubon, not to be confused with the Casaubon that wrote the book on D. Kelly, but this is another Casaubon. He proved that the Hermetic treatises were actually post-Christian and not pre-Christian. And at that point, the Catholic Church decided Hermes Trismegistus was a pagan, and that was anti-Christian, and so ceremonial magic was no longer respected and no longer given the imprimatur of the church, and you would get in a lot of trouble by writing a magic book at that time. Giordano Bruno got burned at the stake. So magic in the continent at least, continental Europe, went into the back alleys. And that was, of course, over in England, they didn't pay attention to it, but still, it had an influence. And then, and the Reformation came up, and they started looking from a more fundamental point of view. And at this point, we had something that developed called the Enlightenment. And this was a result of the Renaissance. And we were having the birth of the scientific method, the birth of the Industrial Revolution. God, people were getting a little, they were getting a little tired of the fundamental version of Catholicism and the fundamental version of even Protestantism, because they had these terrible religious wars and all of this business. So we had the rise of Masonry, which attempted to make peace between all the religions, and we had the rise of intellectuals discrediting the whole process of this dominance of the church and all of this. And meanwhile, in Germany, the back in the back alleys, some little black books start to appear, the Grimoire of Honorius and the Grand Grimoire, and they were pretty grim, too. These things, they're kind of spiritual pornography. What had happened at this point was that we had a character called Faustus, and Faustus called up Mephistopheles and made a pact with him. Now, this, as far as I know, was the first time any magician ever made a pact with any. Before that time, these so-called evil spirits were controlled. You controlled them. You got them to do things where you use the power of God. I'm armed with the power of God. You go out and do this, that for me. Find me a treasure, or do this, that, the other thing. And there was no making any pacts with them. Dr. Faustus, he made a pact with Mephistopheles, and as the more the Industrial Revolution takes over, and the more God gets kind of de-emphasized, and the church power gets threatened, and as we move into what begins to be the modern world, then the powers of darkness, from a magical point of view, start to take over from God's been depowered. A lot of times they don't even believe. Just curiously enough, some people that didn't really believe in God, they really thought, well, if God isn't around and God's dead, maybe the devil's still alive. And the rise of the Faustian school, and that gave way to Satanism, that was used to power Satanism was if you were raised, especially with the Catholic Church, and you had all this sanctimonious stuff poured into you when you were a kid, oh boy, what a kick you could get from being sacrilegious and using that as a spark. So Satanism, as really, although there was exception to the rule, there was a cult called the Luciferians in Germany back in the Middle Ages, where they all got down in caves and said, well, down in the caves, Satan rules and God can't get at us, and so we can do anything we want. That was a medieval cult, but that was a special case. But this satanic thing got started really in the 18th and the early 19th centuries. It really got going. In fact, it you might say it had its higher watermark in the FinSec era, or FinSecle, my French is not that good, era, right at the turn of the century in France, all the way up to the 1890s. This is where Satanism finally got what we might call serious Satanism, was in vogue for a while in France, on the left bank, in the back alleys, and whatever. Now, so there you have Now, you know, actually, even with the so-called serious Satanists, they, whether or not they were really doing black magic, and a lot of times they weren't. They were using sacrilege, and they were using sex act, and they were, as long as it wasn't rape, which they occasionally did that too. But I mean, as long as this was consensual and they weren't exploiting anybody, then they were having a lot of fun. And so you can't really call that black magic, even though you don't like it, but you can't call it black magic. Now, let's talk about types of magic so we can understand what it is, where magic power comes from. So we, you know, types of magic, we got about four, I think. You have the magic of the earth, and that's the spirits of the earth and the mountains and the gnomes and the fairies and the elves and the, you know, and the shaman spirits. That's the spirits the spirits of the power of the earth. And then you have the power of the heavens. That's the sun and the planets and the stars and the astrology and the celestial, and which is usually equated with the pagan gods and God himself. That's the sun, according to Giordano Bruno. And then we have the power of the blood. Now, this was controversial. A lot of magicians, even in the Renaissance, a lot of good magicians, or I don't really call them good, they would sacrifice a chicken, the black and the white cockerel, if you remember from Christopher Lee, one of the movies. And they would, the release of the blood actually is a form of magical power, and it's very effective. And I'm not saying it's bad, because if you are in a rural environment, this is perfectly natural to wipe the heads off of chickens. We do it every day. You know, what the heck's so bad about that? If you're a farm boy. Now, if you're a city kid, and I don't know, you know, you eat a lot of chicken, fried chicken, but when somebody gives you a live chicken and says, cut the head of that chicken off, and you do, that can be kind of nasty. So it just all depends. Are you from the farm, or are you? So consequently, you know, we look at Santa Rita, you know, some of these religions that do a lot of blood sacrifice, and have animals and whatever, and we don't think of the fact that these people were basically rural. They're basically farm people, and so for them this is not terrible, and they're going to eat whatever it is they sacrifice. They're going to eat it anyway, so let's have a barbecue. Okay, so that's not so evil, but blood, however, blood magic can get, you know, it can get really nasty, especially if you start throwing your own blood around, and which, by the way, one of our books by Isaiah Oki on African juju, he actually said that, you know, one of the reasons why AIDS was spreading all over Central Africa, because the juju men were throwing their own blood around, and so you can wonder about that. Now, then there's the power of the sex act. Oh, boy, and that's got a lot of power, and that's not evil. Well, you can make it evil if you want to, but it's not evil. That can be a beautiful thing. And so those are the different ways that you can raise power and magic. Now, you can do this for beneficial purposes, for healing, for prosperity, for protection, or you can be aggressive about it, and you can do it for victory. You can do it with an attack. You can do it acquisitively. In other words, you go out and stealing on the astral or whatever. You can, and worst of all, you can use it for domination and for deception, okay? And that, I hate to say it, but that includes love spells. You go and do, you think about it, you do a love spell on somebody that you want them to love you, you know, you're actually, you know, you're trying to use magic to impose your will on someone else. That's actually a form of black magic. Yeah, yeah. So, this is what black men now. Let's talk about the really, really, really evil forms of black magic. I know it's just, it's what you've all been waiting for. Yeah, what you've all been waiting for. I know one of my dear friends, and I won't mention his name, he's a temple chief. You know, this dear little old lady, student of his, came up and said, "Oh, you have a black belt in karate. Oh, heavens, how can you be a spiritual leader and have a black belt in karate?" And I said, "Oh, my dear, I need some way to sublimate my natural aggressive desires, and this makes me a more peaceful person." And he told me that, and I said, "Well," and one of my students found out that I was practicing ninjutsu, he would probably say, "How do you do the dim mock?" But anyway, the point that I want to make here, though, is that black magic, really, really, really evil black magic, there are certain aspects we'll discuss. The first, and probably the worst, is ghost slaving. Now, ghost slaving has been around for a long, long, long time all over the world. The pharaohs did it. "Hey, bury the pharaoh, and bury the pharaoh with all his favorite wives and people so he could have somebody to serve him in the afterworld." The Vikings did it. Oh, yeah, they slaughtered people and threw them on the ship before they set the ship on fire so the chieftain would have people to serve him in the other world. And then, of course, I think Idi Amin, the dictator of Uganda, supposedly gave some British mercenary the death of 1,000 cuts and in order to ghost slave him. Because a little bit of torture along with murder, that gets the guy on your, you make him swear to serve you in the other world before you kill him. Now, but let's don't blame that just on the on the Egyptians or the Africans or the Chinese, of course, do it too. Let's don't blame it on them. Let's remember that our Southwest Indians also did the same thing. And I found in Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, it's one of the oldest books on magic witchcraft that we have, an account of a Christian preacher who went into a condemned criminal who was about to be hanged and said, "My dear man, if you will serve me for 7 years as a spirit in my crystal, I will pray for you, and at the end of 7 years, you will go to heaven. Sign here." That's ghost slaving. Now, the other really, really bad form of black magic is the black magic used by the Assassin's Cult, which there are a lot of examples of still today in modern times. And that is where you use a very powerful drug to convince the person that they're in paradise. And then when he wakes up, you give him the dagger and say, "Now, go off to the mosque, and as the caliph comes out of the mosque, you run up and plunge the dagger in his heart. And don't worry, they'll kill you, but you'll go to paradise. And we just showed you what paradise was like." So off he goes, and wacko. Now, does that sound somewhat like some of the stuff that's going on with these suicide bombers and all the 72 virgins in paradise and all of that? That's black magic. That's black magic and of the worst, one of the worst kinds. So I said that black magic is attack, theft on the astral, theft of setting up a theft for yourself, domination, and even to include love spells, deception. This is real black magic. Now, this can be done. You could put on white robes and a cross and go out and invoke Jesus and then bring down the Archangel Michael and ask him to do it for you. It'd still be black magic. Now, I have a suspicion myself, looking at the records and all that more black magic has been done in the name of God than it was ever done in the name of the devil. And so I'm not a Satanist, and the devil told me one time that I was, but I mean I'm not really. But this Faustian school, we're making pacts with demons and with the devil. Now, something I'd like to mention here. That one of the reasons why the dark side began to gain power was the rise of the Industrial Revolution and the rise of the dissatisfaction as people stopped depending on the church, and as they became more urbanized, they began to be much more dissatisfied with life and much more aware of the hypocrisy of the church, whatever. An example of the more modern attitude toward this is William Blake, the famous, now he's famous, of course, when he was alive, nobody already paid any attention to him, but William Blake, the mystic and the poet and the artist, the inventor of the comic book, William Blake was an ardent Swedenborgian. And Swedenborg was a great, terrific mystic and really knew what the other world was all about and all of that. But Swedenborg was insufferably moral. He was so moral that it was really you take Swedenborg's book, Heaven and Hell, and it's a great big fat thing, it's about 500 pages long. You can go through that book, and everywhere he uses the word good, if you cut that out, you would shorten the book by over a half. And Blake, who was an artist and a writer and a poet and a very creative individual, he couldn't stand Swedenborg's continual talking about any kind of creative vanity was sinful. Oh, if you want to create, if you had pride in your creation, if you did were sinful, that was not good. Ooh, on and on and on about this. And Blake said, wait a minute, I'm an artist, I'm a writer, I'm a poet. What's sinful about that? So, to rebel against Swedenborg, he wrote a little book, a little comic book, called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And this was right down the line with what the old magicians were kind of believed. In other words, that the demons have the knowledge and they have the art and they're creative. And the angels, of course, have the wisdom and they have the power, but the creativity and the knowledge to create, that comes from the demonic side. Now, this is a very, very good theory, and it has a lot of truth to it, because we all have a dark side. And that dark side fascinates, we're all fascinated by it, even the people that try to deny it all the time. They have a dark side, we all do. We all have a dark side. And it really is a very good idea for a creative, mystical individual who has this desire to practice magic. It's good to be able to manifest that dark side, get it under control, make it work for you. Now, of course, we did this in the OTA. I discovered through my little bit of research I was doing there that the so-called demon Astaroth was actually the goddess Astarte. And the so-called demon Baal was actually the god Baal. And these were the two Canaanite the god and goddess that Solomon secretly worshipped. And so, of course, the rabbis and the priests and all the rest of them, they turned them into demons. Well, yeah, they turned them into demons. So you bring them up and you find out they're very, very beautiful and powerful people, or gods and goddesses. So the dark side, if it's the dark side, it can be certainly useful and it can be creative. And you need to, I think, that being an old-fashioned magician, I like to balance it. I like to balance it with the power of God, and I like the light. And I think light is creative in its own sense. The light's power creative. The dark side is intellectually and spiritually creative, whereas the light side gives the power charge. That's the great positive animating flow. But in the darkness is the art, and the knowledge and the art is in the dark side. So it's a balance, and I think that Blake's Marriage of Evandale is very good in that respect. Now, let's look at this thing from the point of view of too much adoration or too much orientation on the dark side. I don't think that that's particularly good. Now, with some people, they really are oriented toward this. And this seems to be what they really, really oriented toward. Now, they aren't necessarily evil. Somehow the light is just, the light really doesn't have that much attraction for them, and the balance just something they really don't concern themselves with. Well, all right, for them, I suppose that's okay. However, just because they are fascinated by the dark side and they don't care that much about the light, doesn't necessarily mean they're evil or even that they're bad. I enjoy Kenneth Grant's books. I have all of Kenneth Grant's books. And I think Kenneth Grant is just delightful. Oh, boy, is it dark. He is a guy that invented the tunnels of Set underneath the paths of the Tree of Life. He's got these tunnels, and they're full of demons. And he did such a good job with this that they have gotten into, they're now officially canonized. And if you go to Skinner's Magical Companion and you go to Godwin's Cabalistic Encyclopedia, you're going to find those tunnels of Set all listed. They're just as much a part of magic now as Barton. And anyway, the dark side is really, we all have it. And we all should certainly, be familiar with it. And it isn't necessarily evil. But I want to point out, while we're on that subject, maybe just an example, though, about how this kind of thing works. Now, when we started the OTA, we were using, the original Galatia, the one that DeLawrence published, of course. That was the first one that was available, generally available. And we knew that Astarte and Baal were Ashtaroth and Baal and whatever. But then our assumption was that the rest of these so-called evil spirits, and they're not really evil, these rebellious spirits, they're not necessarily evil. We assumed that, if Baal and Astarte were in there, a lot of them. So we look at the descriptions of them and figure out from the descriptions of what they do and what they want, whether or not they're really that bad. And we just, and it says, appear in fair and human form. After all the hieroglyphical stuff that you see. It comes in as a bear with three horns and two legs, but then a fear and fear in human form, without horror or deformity or without delay. So they had these, most of them had these rather nice anthropomorphic images. And most of them, we found out, were kind of nice people. I mean, they were spirits. And you had to control them, but they were not that bad. Now, that's because we went along with the Galatia and put them in a Christian Tartarus, in a Dante-esque, the Christian church was kind of, they owed a lot to paganism, and so consequently they didn't want to put the pagans, they knew they couldn't put them in heaven, so they put them in the top reaches of hell. So they had a kind of they created a hell that really wasn't too terribly bad. It was the top level of it was just kind of gloomy, like the Greek underworld, and that's where the virtuous pagans ended up. And then it got a little worse, it went down, and he finally got down to the bottom, and it got pretty bad. But because of that, our so-called demons, the gracious spirits, had a chance to be really fallen angels, and they were supposed to be, and they're kind of nice. And they're exotic, and they do interesting things for you, like Dantalion, oh boy, it's a lot of fun. And some of them are kind of nasty. Osei, woo! Boy, I remember Osei. He says, I'm not an evil spirit. I'm just a spirit of evil. Osei's something else. But the thing that I want to get across here, though, is that Steve Savdo over in Florida decides that he's going to do it the hard way. Now, Steve grew up in a Jewish home, really, really steeped in. In fact, he did it. He translated the Sefer Raziel, and it's just beautiful. And Steve decided he was going to do Galatia, and he's going to do it the hard way. So they got this warehouse in Fort Lauderdale in the summertime, no air conditioning, sealed themselves in there, he and his buddies, and they sealed themselves into this place. They stayed in there for about 5 days, and they fasted, and they conjured, and they must have sweated off 20 pounds apiece. And they just, no mirror, no crystal, no conjuration device, just gut it until they got a manifestation. But they did it, they perceived all of these Galatian spirits as existing on the Jewish Klephoth, not the Christian Tartarus, I'm saying, the way they were supposed to be. But they decided to put them on the Klephoth. So what happened when they finally got their manifestation? They got it, yeah. Right? These spirits all looked like gargoyles, and they couldn't tell them anything except very, very archaic black magic, and that was all they could talk about. And they all looked like gargoyles off the top of a French cathedral, or a Hollywood horror movie, or something like that. And that's because they placed them in their own minds, in their own way of looking at this thing, in the Klephoth. And the Klephoth is much, much, much nastier than the Christian Tartarus. Trust me. So, what you get on the dark side, depending upon how where your orientation is, it's kind of what you're going to, where you're at. Your dark side is going to be maybe darker than somebody else's dark side. Still, it's not the dark side. And so, when you get right down to it, the so-called evil spirits, they're not evil, that's all of them. Some of them are, but they are rebellious, and it's up to you to control them. And you, as a magician, need to control them. Now, but you say, I don't like all that God stuff, and I don't like, I rammed all that down my throat when I was a kid, and I don't like Jesus, and I don't like God, and I don't like those angels. Well, okay. All right, fine. But I think it's a good idea to go find yourself a pagan pantheon, man. Go find a pagan pantheon. Yeah, see if you like Zeus, or you know, maybe you might like the fairy religion, or you maybe like some kind of a pantheon where you've got some positive forces that you can identify with that'll help you get control over the non-positive force. I think this is the best way to do it. But still, I'm not saying that that if you're strictly on the dark side, you're necessarily evil. No. I just don't think it's the best thing in the world for you. But then again, on the other hand, what do I know? You might be that way, and that's where you want to be. Now, let's talk about, for instance, let's talk about the Necronomicon. Oh, boy, the Necronomicon. Oh, well. Now, I think everybody knows at this point that Howard Phillips Lovecraft invented the Necronomicon. There never was a Necronomicon, and since he invented it, there has been a mania, just an obsession on the part of so many people. It's been this obsession to reify this book. Oh, there's a real Necronomicon. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, there isn't. But there are books that are kind of like it. I think it owes something. If you took Picatrix and John Dee's Enochian system and kind of shuffle them together, you might come up with something similar in some ways. Dee and Kelly's Call of the 38ers is pretty apocalyptic, and the Picatrix has some stuff in there. But there's never, that I know of, been an ancient grimoire or a medieval grimoire that was totally evil. But the Necronomicon, that's what it supposedly was. These were the ancient old ones, and they didn't care anything for humanity. They were our enemies. They wanted to come back from another dimension and take over the world and devour us all. So why would anybody want to summon these things? You got to ask yourself that. Why? Why would you want to? Well, that the answer to that is there are a lot of people, unfortunately, in the mystical, magical realm and whatever, there's a lot of people who really they want the world to be destroyed. They don't want to go to be raptured to heaven or anything like that. They really, really are in love with evil. I mean, and yet they're not evil themselves. These people, some of these people are the nicest folks you'd ever want to meet, and they wouldn't hurt anybody. They're not themselves evil, but yet they want evil to triumph. I'd have no answer for this, but I can tell you this, that the very fact that the Necronomicon has had developed such a devoted following and these people absolutely want this thing to be real, it indicates that there are people who sincerely do want to destroy everything. And they're against the very humanity that they're members of. Why is this? I don't know. You have to ask yourself, why would you want to practice a form of magic that brings in your mortal enemies of the human race and places you completely in their power when you know they are going to destroy you? And not only are they going to destroy you, they're going to eat your soul. There's hit it right, just as soon as I say that, here comes a siren out there. So the Necronomicon, the fascination for the Necronomicon, to me as a magician, is a mystery. That is more of a mystery than the origin of the Necronomicon itself, because, as I say, Lovecraft invented it, and Lovecraft swore up and down that he was not an occultist, but he did do a lot of research, of course. Now, so this indicates that that there is a growing fascination for the dark side, but I must go back again and say that if you really want the dark side and you like it and all of that, look at old Kenneth Grant's books. Poor Kenneth, he made it to about 90, I guess, and so I guess he was doing pretty well with it, and he just passed on. And Kenneth Grant, just delightfully, intellectually satisfying, dark, sinister stuff. But here again, I don't think old Kenneth and his wife Steffi, I don't think there's anything evil about them. And we sure enjoy their writing. So I think we can say that the truly evil people. A truly evil people, well, to summarize a little bit, fall into the category of the calculating genius sociopath. This is a truly evil person, or can be a truly evil person. Now, religious fanatics, well, you know, they kill and blow themselves up in the name of God. Are they evil, or are they just, do they really believe that they're doing the will of God? I don't know. Is that evil or not? And the true believers and doing horrible things. Remember, some of the worst atrocities the world's ever seen have been done in the name of God, and by people who, in many cases, firmly believed they were doing the will of God. Now, if you are a hermetic magician, you have your morality, because you are the center of the universe, and the only person you're answerable to is the God within yourself. That's all. You're not answerable to anybody else. And so the only measure of the hermetic magician's morality is his empathy for other human beings. This is his morality. Now, next week we are going to have a very, very astute private investigator lady who uses occult science in her profession, and she is really, really good at this and has a lot of experience. And so next week we're going to be doing the occult private investigation techniques and by a professional. So be sure and tune in next week, and we'll meanwhile, good magic.